We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're back with one of my favorite guests. That would be Todd Bensman, who has a fantastic new piece out at the Center for Immigration Studies. Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here anytime.
Now, Todd, your new report, I think, is, I'll just read the headline. New Migrant Superhighway Bringing the World from South America to Texas. The subhead is Biden Diplomacy Shortens Infamous Darien Gap Passage and Increases Access to Fast Pass Mexican Visas. What this story describes is an incredible acceleration in the border crisis that will be felt in the coming months. I have heard basically not a piece about it from the legacy media, but it does seem to also have been a very direct result of Biden administration policies. So, Todd, I think a good place to start is if you could describe for us the Darien Gap and what it means to people who make this trek up through South and Central America, eventually to the Mexican border.
Sure. Well, between 40 and 50% of everyone who is reaching the U.S. southern border is from some country other than Central America or Mexico. They're from 150 nations throughout the world. It's the highest proportion of illegal immigration that we've ever seen in living memory, coming from so many different countries. And the way they do it is on a migrant route that has been long established from South America into Central America via Colombia and Panama, right into the isthmus of the Central American states. That is called the Darien Gap. It's about a 60-mile, normally 10-day trek through jungle wilderness, very dangerous, notorious for banditry and snakes and flooding rivers and a lot of dead immigrants. Since Joe Biden became president, we have seen historic numbers travel through there. I mentioned already 40%, 50% of everybody coming here is from one of those other countries. But we had about 140,000 cross through the Darien Gap in just 2021. And that compares to a typical 10,000 or less in any given year prior to that, to give you an idea of the scale of this. So people were dying, and the New York Times went down there late last year, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and did big stories about how dangerous it was and how women and children were dying and pregnant women. These are the demographics of people that were specifically being let into the United States. That's why they were coming. That's why they were dying. That's usually a young male passage. But now you had, you know, families with children and pregnant women who were being let in. That's why they were coming. So following those stories, the Biden administration started shuttle diplomacy throughout the region. They were visiting. Blinken was down there. Mayorkas was down there. A bunch of State Department and DHS representatives went down there. And then long about February, March, we noticed a shortcut. No longer does it take 10 days to get through the Darien Gap, but it takes now 2 days. And the way they arranged that was the Panamanian Coast Guard, or equivalent of a Coast Guard — they don't really have a Coast Guard — but had previously been blocking the ocean routes north on the Caribbean side, withdrew, and now allowed the smuggler boats from Colombia to land further up the coast and to take rivers inland into Panama. This shortened the whole thing and created what I'm calling a super highway. I mean, you could just say it's they had a ribbon cutting ceremony, basically, metaphorically, you know, for this brand new route. And there was another shorter one that was opened up on the Pacific coast. So now the New York Times stories, the Washington Post stories, and all those stories, Axios, everybody who went down there, those stories are now obsolete because almost nobody is going that route anymore. They're doing the shortcut routes that were diplomatically hammered out. So that is, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to ask on that diplomatic, the hammering out diplomatically question, what do we know about the Biden administration's involvement in inducing these changes?
Well, they're not taking credit, and I point that out in my piece. They have not issued press releases specifically saying what they did. They did sign a bilateral agreement with Panama that talked about that they were going to regularize migration, that they were going to do things that managed migration in a better way, and it left it at that. You know, if you have Cinefront, which is the equivalent of, you know, the Border Patrol, pulling its patrol boats back, that means that that's a government decision made out of Panama City. And it all coincides very closely in and around all of this diplomacy that has been happening between the Americans and Panama. At the very least, you know, we're not hearing anybody from the State Department object or, you know, raise any issues or alarm bells about a shorter route. So, yeah.
Well, and what's interesting about that is the question of a shorter route is pretty much in line with the Biden administration's general and the Democratic Party's general approach to immigration policy. And you have a good quote in the story. I don't have it in front of me right now about how they want to make it humane. And what's it? Do you remember the quote that I'm thinking of? Yes.
Yeah, it's more of a mantra than a quote. You hear this from the president all the time, and Kamala Harris, and everybody just says the same thing, that they want safe, humane, and orderly migration as their policy objective for immigration to the border, not deterrence and deportation or anything like that. But, you know, we want to grease these skids and make it safe, orderly, and humane. So this would certainly fall right in line with that policy objective. And in fact, the bilateral agreement, if you read it, it's short, like, you know, a page. They use that term liberally in there. So...
And it's interesting because to the, you know, the casual observer, they might say, well, great. This means that, you know, you've shortened this route by 8 days, which means you have 8 days less of risk for people who are going to take this trip. And so safe, humane, and orderly is, you know, that is the humane ambition. That's exactly what we should be trying to do. But there's really nothing humane, Todd, and you can speak to this, about incentivizing people to take this trip, period, which is going to be inevitably the outcome of the policy.
That's right. The argument would be, and it is true, that there was a terrible body count on the old route. And I mean, you know, pregnant women and corpses of children. And, you know, I've got a big stack of testimonies that I've personally taken from immigrants who have passed through there. So it will save lives, probably, but also, you know, this will cost lives as well, because you're going to have an inducement for greater numbers of people to make that 2 or 3 day trek. It's not entirely safe. The bandits have discovered it. People are being sexually assaulted on that shorter route. They are being robbed and hurt. And some people are being killed even on that shorter route. But it's not just through there, but that there is risk beyond this route in Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico all the way through. And it's not necessarily more humane that way. You could argue that it's less humane more people are going to be hurt, more people are going to die than would have even at the high rates now. And beyond that, it's just inducing people to come to our border and cross it.
The other obvious consequence of this is more business for cartels in Mexico and in Central America. Can you talk a little bit about how a policy like this, along the same logic that you were just outlining, is ultimately a financial gift to cartels?
Well, yeah, of course, particularly when they reach northern Mexico and want to cross the U.S. border, huge swaths of southern Texas in particular are controlled entirely by the Gulf Cartel or CDN. And there are other cartels in Arizona, the Sinaloa and La Linea, that control these crossings and charge huge fees to just for the, you know, to wade across. It's not even that. It's not even a big crossing. They just say, you know, this is the cost, this is the toll. There is good reporting out there that shows that the Mexican cartels are now making more money from human smuggling because of these numbers than they were from their primary source of drug trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And that empowers them. They can buy more weapons. They can stave off any sort of Mexican government intervention in their activity. It destabilizes the Mexican state over a long period of time. And I didn't even tell you yet about the other component here, which is the big change that these diplomatic shuttle diplomacy that's been going on with Mexico has wrought on its southern border. Big change down there.
Tell us more about that.
And it all happened simultaneously with the Darien Gap change. What we're seeing down there now, only in Spanish language media and a few Mexican journalists who are on the scene. In the past, for the last 3 years, I would say probably 3.5, 4 years even, the Mexican government has had a National Guard deployment on its southern border at Donald Trump's insistence. We're going to hit you with trade tariffs and ruin your economy if you don't put it down there and stop the immigration on the Guatemala border with Mexico. Slow it down, block it up. The Biden administration maintained it. They asked the Mexicans to keep that National Guard down there and to keep slowing them down. So the southern city of Tapachula, for example, which I visited numerous times, was that some people called it a prison city because they would block them up down there and say you have to apply for Mexican asylum, and they would slow roll it so that it would take 3 or 4 months. You'd have 40, 50,000 immigrants stacked up there. The immigrants eventually would riot and create such domestic disturbances that the Mexican government then would just release them all at once. So it didn't completely stop it, but it definitely was a speed bump. And now what's happening following this diplomacy is the National Guard is standing aside and walking, guarding the caravans as they make their way north on these brand new temporary visas that are being handed out to everybody who comes in immediately. So they have this fast pass straight to the U.S. border now, whereas just like a month ago, 2 months ago, they were still being blocked up down there.
So
this is a very significant change.
Cancel culture is coming to your bank, and holding the wrong political views might soon leave you out in the cold. I'm Bill Walton. On the latest episode of The Bill Walton Show, Todd Zwicky, Paul Watkins, and I discuss what is already happening, how the Biden administration is already pursuing this agenda, and what we can do about it. This progressive culture offensive is relentless. It's coming for you, and you won't hear about this anywhere else. Follow The Bill Walton Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's that is absolutely huge. And I wonder what the interplay is between the basic fast pass, the fast pass visas that the Mexican government is handing out, and also the protection that migrants pay for from cartels, especially at Tapachula, when they're coming into the country. What does that look like, getting credentials from the Mexican government now that they're handing out the fast passes from this particular region, for instance? What does that mean for cartel activity?
Well, the traditional Mexican cartels I've been talking about here, their main activity is on the northern border. But that doesn't mean that there aren't groups of what's called polleros down there that are indigenous smugglers. But whereas when they had the National Guard down there, they would have to, in order to get around them, hire those local groups to smuggle past. And in a great many cases, they would just pay off the National Guard. I'm not telling you that the National Guard was hugely effective when Biden took office. They were much more so when Trump was in office, because he had that trade tariffs threat hanging over the Mexicans all the time, and some other policies as well. But now what's happening is that they are forming caravans in Tapachula. They get their 7-day permiso. And then the National Guard just looks the other way as they walk 50 miles to this other town called Huixla.
Mm.
And in that town, they get their 30-day visa. And they use the 30-day visa to head straight to the U.S. border. There's no more of this waiting around for 4 or 5 months or 3 or 5 months for Mexican asylum, which, is a whole other kind of a process. So the numbers are so large waiting for, there's a long line for these fast passes. So there, you can still see them kind of stuck down there, but they're stuck down there in a different way. they're just in a line that's going to, they're waiting to get their fast passes out, according to local Mexican reporting.
Mm.
And there's a couple of journalists who are down there, filming and videoing all of this.
And so it's
passed through. And in July, just to give you an idea, the very first caravan was allowed to pass through the National Guard. And in the month of July, there were 16 more that are just let right through to the border, our border.
And so it's a matter of Guardia Nacional from point A to point B, turning away from caravans as they go from point A to point B.
Yeah, or in some cases even guarding them.
Right.
And everybody's probably getting their cut. There's payoffs. There's a video recently of a Guatemalan police officer outside one of the buses just collecting money from everybody. Everybody's getting their cut from this.
Mm. And
now, just real quickly,
Kind
of pair these things together. If you put what they did in Panama together with what they did in southern Mexico, those were the two impediment areas. They've shortcutted the Darien Gap, and now they've done this new thing in Mexico, is why I call this a superhighway.
And I wanted to ask you more about that, too. AMLO actually just met with Biden, 3-4 weeks ago now. So what do we know about, first of all, the Biden administration's approach to talking to AMLO about what his policies are in Mexico? And what do we know about shifts in his policies in terms of how Mexico handles this problem?
It's very confusing because first of all, the Biden administration very rarely is transparent about what they've talked about or what their agreements are afterwards. They almost never really say what was going on in these things. But on the other hand, the Biden administration has pursued, it's been conflicted internally by a fear of the midterms coming up. How this looks in the polls to Americans, even Democrats, these gigantic numbers coming over the southern border. And so the Biden administration, on the one hand, wants to shut it down. They want Mexico to do things to shut it down. And on the other hand, they're like, yeah, help bring everybody in. know, so it's just literally cross currents canceling each other out all the time. So right now, for example, the Mexicans are starting to do deportation flights of extracontinental immigrants on its territory, not in huge numbers, but I think that those deportation flights had something to do with the Biden visit and some other visits. Like, you know, Mexico is now expected to, you know, sew up its own southern border. And they're not doing it. They're, you know, they're giving them fast passes. So it's just incredibly confusing to figure out, you know, what does the Biden administration want and expect? Do they want to be border hawks, or do they want to be given to their progressive wing and talk about humane and orderly migration? You can't have it both ways. It's all or nothing. Or it doesn't work.
It's incredibly bizarre to me, and I think we've talked about this before, Todd, how, I mean, you've been covering this for years, and you've been to Central America, you've been to Mexico many, many times, and you've spoken to migrants, spoken to officials. It's extremely confounding how the framing of, quote, humane immigration is used to counterintuitively incentivize the least humane process of immigration imaginable, basically. How do you think that happened? Obviously, powerful political interests are behind spinning it that way, but how has it come so that the sort of dominant, definitive idea of what humane immigration looks like is so profoundly inhumane?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a debate about, you know, if you listen to progressives and study their statements and their ideology, you know, I'm talking about the Bernie Sanders kind of progressives. What they talk about is they say that no enforcement, zero enforcement is how you save lives. If you just let everybody in the way they want to come in, when they want to come in, nobody dies. That's their vision. A border hawk, somebody who is in favor of secured borders, looks at it the other way. If you were to just deter and slow down and block, deport, enforce your laws, then fewer people will come and fewer people will die. And that's kind of the fulcrum upon which the whole debate lays. So in the beginning of the Biden administration, the progressives came in holding full sway over immigration policy. They took over, they were given immigration policy, and they were able to implement that vision of everybody. We want to end deportation, we want to end detention, and we want to open the asylum system wide to everybody, which is highly abused, right? So somewhere around July, after, you know, about a million people came in, Biden administration realized it had a political problem. Ron Klein, chief of staff, and also Susan Rice and others were asked to shut it down. Start getting border hawk on this stuff. And they did. They did a lot of things that you and I would think might be out of character for the Biden administration. They were doing massive air deportation flights for months. Those are still going on, even. But then at the same time, they were having, you know, exemptions to Title 42 of letting hundreds of thousands of people into the country. And it just simply canceled out the deterrent measures that they were doing, but it made people like you and me and probably most of your listeners completely confused about what was going on.
Were a lot of those flights for Haitians or down to South America?
A lot of them were for Haitians, but they started deporting, you know, Guatemalans long before they were deporting Haitians and Hondurans, and they're flying to Africa and Asia and Colombia.
Well, that's another thing I wanted to ask you about is you're one of the few people that reports on some of the crazy information. I mean, this is a headline of yours from April about those 42 terrorists who crossed the American southern border. The U.S. government now publishing terrorist watch list encounters at American land borders. Todd, again, this is something you hear pretty much nothing about in the legacy media, is obviously important. What can you tell us about non-Central and South America migration? John Daniel Davidson and I were down in Tamaulipas recently, and you know, we talked to a Ukrainian couple, and the director of the shelter that they were at told us he's seen a lot of Ukrainians. But you have reporting here on terrorist watch list encounters. What can you tell us about people coming from all parts of the world, and what some of those numbers look like?
Well, yes, we know about terror watch listed immigrants that are crossing over because really inexplicably the Biden administration decided to add a page to their CBP statistics page on FBI watch listed migrants that are caught. So you could just go to their website now and look it up. And there it all is. And we've had really about 112 FBI watch-listed migrants actually reach the southern border and be apprehended. These are people who are already on the watch list. Now, the numbers of those are extremely high. Usually it's under 20 in a given year, and that's on Mexican side too. These are, I mean, we had like, I think just in May, we had 16 alone, don't quote me, or, you know, I could be wrong on that. In that, I'm on the radio, I guess. But
no, you're good.
I just don't have the stats in front of me, but it was a large number just in May, and in June and July. And so I think clearly the world beyond South America and in the Middle East now are very well aware that the border is wide open and everybody is on their way, including bad guys. And that's just the ones who are on the watch list. You know, we are seeing a lot of Somalis come through. We're seeing a lot of Iranians and Syrians and Iraqis. And there are people who might not be on the watch list. Afghanis, lots of Afghanis coming through, couldn't get their refugee packages done.
And so they basically get flights into Central America and come up that way?
Well, a lot of them are flying into South American countries, Ecuador, Brazil, Argentina, et cetera. And then they were coming through the Darien Gap, making their way. I don't think that many of them were flying into Mexico, but some of them could have easily flown into Guatemala or those other countries as well.
Todd, this whole conversation it reminds me of another story you've written recently. Here's another headline of yours. Are Democrat mayors really just now waking up to the greatest mass migration border crisis in U.S. history? Democratic mayors like here in Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, have been upset, for instance, with Governor Greg Abbott's decision to bus migrants, people who have crossed the southern border into Texas, up to Union Station right here on Capitol Hill, steps from where lawmakers work and live. I wonder what you think this tells us about how divorced some proponents of this very inhumane immigration system are from the reality that some border states have been really experiencing for years.
Well, the first time that I discovered a conveyor belt, a mechanized, industrialized conveyor belt that was moving illegal border crossers straight into American cities was in about March of 2021, I went down to the border and just stumbled across these buses that were just being loaded up one after another with Haitians, mostly at that time,
cut just fresh off the border, and nobody in the country had reported this, that this thing's happened. And I boarded the buses and I asked everybody where they're going. And, you know, a whole bunch of them said New York, New Jersey, Tennessee, Kentucky. They listed all the places they were going. And then that conveyor belt system continued nonstop and only grew all along the southern border. Buses filling up with freshly crossed immigrants going to New York City and to Washington, D.C., and all along the eastern seaboard and all along the northwest and the LA and everything in between for 18 months straight. In May, I was just down there again, and I went to the same place that I first saw the conveyor belt, and it was 7 days a week, buses all day long, 7 days a week from just this one spot, thousands and thousands. So the question then becomes, if you're the mayor of New York, and these people have been just pouring into your city for 18 months straight in buses, how did you not know of them until you just saw them in your homeless shelters and tried to blame it on a Republican governor? You found some political points with it. My point is that I believe that mayors across America have been suffering in silence over this. I think that they have been overwhelmed in all of their social services. I don't have the reporting to back this up, but I'd almost be willing to bet a paycheck on it. Somebody needs to go scratch the surface in all these other cities, and you should find all of their social service safety nets and schools just sagging under the weight of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that the only two places that where it kind of cropped into a public view were these two cities where the mayors just kind of stumbled into, you know, they didn't realize that complaining about what they were complaining about, you know, would be kind of a political embarrassment for them, because they're acknowledging that there is a mass migration crisis of historic, epic proportions filling up American cities. It's going to go on.
I wonder also, these are two, New York City and Washington, D.C. are both sanctuary cities to some extent, and those policies have to be part of what incentivizes migrants to come and put stresses on those other states and on those other mayors. And so it's almost as though they're getting just a taste of what their policies themselves have brought upon the country, because just the knowledge of, you know, cities that exist as so-called sanctuary cities, it has to be something that drives people to cross the border.
Well, I agree. I mean, there are lots of reasons why these immigrants pick the cities they pick. The chief reason that I'm told is, you know, I have family there.
Right.
Or I have friends who have jobs for me to get me work and I can stay with them, that sort of thing. But a lot of them don't know where they're going, where they're going to end up. And those people who are ending up in the shelters, the homeless shelters, understand that these cities are going to be, you know, generous with social welfare benefits, that they're going to be soup kitchens. Nobody's going to starve to death. Nobody's going to not have a place to sleep and that kind of thing. And, you know, there's a reason why there are so many homeless people in Washington, D.C. They know where the food is, you know, where the free stuff is. And so, you know, you can walk down any street in, you know, the district and, you know, there's just homeless people everywhere.
Right.
It's the same with New York. And I think that word spreads fast in the immigrant community. They're all connected by chat rooms and on cell phones, and they know where to go.
Todd, as someone who has done reporting on these issues in Central America and South America, I'm wondering what you think of the so-called pink wave that just sort of swept through elections in which you saw socialist candidates elected in South and Central America. And there's a lot of those explanations pointing to the economic effects of the pandemic. You know, people say that really created an appetite for these types of politicians in those regions. You know, what does, from your perspective, what do those elections tell us about the situation that so many people are escaping from as they try to come up here to the United States?
Yeah, you know, it just sort of ebbs and flows down there. You get these, you know, Bolivia, Peru, you know, these Venezuela some years ago that just kind of toggle from right to left and right. I guess they're kind of going into left mode more and more of these countries. I think Biden or the State Department is sending representatives right now to Honduras, which just elected somebody who is just like right on the edge of communists. And I think that it just has to do with economics and maybe name recognition, or, you know, it's just, it toggles back and forth. And for us, I'm not so sure that it has that much effect on the immigration flow. They're going to come when the door is open, and our door is open.
And that's a perfect place to transition to my last question, Todd, is what can you tell us about the increase that has been pretty evident over the course of this year? The numbers, I think, have already surpassed 2 million encounters, or maybe I'm not being precise with my statistics. Either way, record setting. And what do those numbers look like during this year of Joe Biden's administration?
Well, they're just epic. I mean, last year we thought we'd seen the biggest numbers in history, and it's just stair-stepped ever higher, despite even efforts by the administration to get those numbers back down. What happened is they announced the end of Title 42, and they gave a date, May 23rd. A court intervened. It's still in place, but with lots and lots of exemptions and loopholes punched into it. That's the pandemic-related expulsion policy. When they announced that and gave a date for it, in, I believe it was March, my palm slapped my forehead. One of those moments. It's like, oh, here they come. They gave a date. You know, they said that they're going to end Title 42, gave a date. And of course, that's what happened. You know, the entire world just surged forward, filled every possible shelter in northern Mexico, built camps, expanding, exploding everywhere. Waiting for the end of Title 42. When Title 42 got stayed, those people just came over. And there were exemptions made for people who had not been exempted before, or they left escape hatches. And I'll give you an example. They cut a deal with Mexico to take back Cubans and Nicaraguans, who are in huge numbers. But they said, we'll only take them in these certain areas, but they left the Del Rio sector open. So everybody heard about it. So all the Cubans and Nicaraguans poured into Del Rio and got straight in. So they leave these hatches open and they just can't get a grip on it. And it's like almost nobody can understand, why are we having so many people pour over the border? When we have Title 42, it's because they make these exemptions and carve out escape hatches like that.
Right. Oh, Todd Bensman, Senior National Security Fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. Thank you, as always, for joining Federalist Radio Hour.
Thank you very much.
Todd's book on all of this is called America's Covert Border War. You should make sure to check that out. You can follow his work at CIS.org, also at ToddBensman.com, where you should definitely sign up for his newsletter. I follow Todd's work very closely via the newsletter. It's such a great way to get this excellent reporting delivered straight to your inbox. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
Reason, and then it faded away.